Case number 12-1431, Center for Sustainable Economy Petitioner versus Sally Jewell et al. Mr. Livermore for the petitioner, Mr. Shilton for the respondent.
Mr. Livermore.
May it please the court, I'm Mike Livermore for petitioner, Center for Sustainable Economy. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Interior's 2012-2017 leasing program governs the allocations of hundreds of billions of dollars worth of resources owned by the American people and authorizes activities with a wide range of substantial environmental and social risks. Congress established the Outer Continental Shelf's Land Act Section 18 planning process so that the leasing program would be deliberate and reflect consideration of energy needs as well as environmental, social, and regional factors. As this court has held in Watt v. Interior in 1981 and subsequent challenges to the program, the agency is obligated to consider the factors that are enumerated in Section 18A1 and A2 and to strike a proper balance between the risks and benefits of Outer Continental Shelf development under Section 18A3. Three flaws identified in the Center for Sustainable Economy's challenge.
You may want to establish your standing.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Sure.
Yep. My pleasure.
You may not want to give us the full history anyway. Excuse me. Go ahead and tell me, please, why the organization claims organizational standing. What is your harm as an organization?
So the court need not get to the organizational standing.
You may not want us to.
We have associational standing.
Your ground is not too solid there. Go ahead. Why do you have standing in any form?
In any case, thank you, Your Honor. So the organization is standing quite equivalent to the organization in Center for Biological Diversity versus Interior, which was decided in 2009, the most recent challenge to the program. Petitioner in that case, of course, was a membership organization as the Center for Sustainable Economy.
Are you, in fact, a membership organization?
Yeah, we are. The Center is a membership.
What tells us that in the record?
In the declaration of the president of the Center, John Telrick, he affirms that the Center is a membership organization, that the Center's bylaws and directives include membership categories, that members participate in the Center's projects and programs, and they're consulted to shape the organization's priorities and activities.
Now, with reference to the two standing affidavits of individuals, do they establish their membership in the organization?
They state that they are members in the organization, yes.
Now, what purpose of the organization, as representative of its members, is impaired by the acts of the respondent, and what is the remediation that we can provide for that?
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. So we have a procedural injury theory of standing here.
You understand that procedural injury for standing purposes requires a substantive right.
Absolutely.
That is protected by the procedure.
Correct. The concrete interest is protected by the procedure in this case are the recreational and economic interests that are attested to in the declarant's declarations. Ms. Wilson's economic and recreational interests in the Gulf and Mr. Shavelson's recreational interests in the waters and coastal lands of Alaska. Moving forward from standing, if there are no further questions on that issue.
Can I ask, where did it say the bylaws and the...
The bylaws are not in the record.
They're not in the record?
That's correct. The president of the organization is attested to the relevant features
of
the bylaws.
Is there anything in the record that supports that proposition?
Other than the declaration of the president attesting to the relevant features of the bylaws, that's what's in the record, Your Honor.
I wondered about that. Is there any precedent about whether the bylaws themselves would have to be in to support or just...
Not that we're aware of. So the government raises this question and asks that the Hunt and DCF membership criteria be applied in this circumstance. There's no case that we're aware of applying the DCF membership test to an organization that affirmatively affirms that it's a membership organization. Where it's been applied, it's been in situations such as Fund Democracy, where the petitioner or the plaintiff in the case is representing an informal consortium or some other non-membership situation.
To be honest, I don't really understand your argument on that. How can you have representational standing for your members if you don't have members?
We do have members. It's a member organization, exactly.
So what is your point about whether this is a Hunt-type organization or not a Hunt-type organization?
The point is that the Hunt criteria, the indicia of membership criteria, has been applied to non-membership organizations to determine if they are sufficiently like membership organizations to merit associations.
You're claiming that you are a membership.
Exactly. That was just responsive to Judge Pillar's question about whether the bylaws have been required.
What the bylaws say, we have members and they are in the following categories?
I can represent that, yes, Your Honor. They say that there's members. It describes a voting process for the members to select the board of the board that governs the organization.
So the members elect the board?
Yes, that's correct.
Wouldn't it have been a good idea to put that in the record?
The president attested to the relevant features of the
bylaw. Wouldn't it have been a good idea to put that in the record?
It would have been a good idea to put it in the record, Your Honor. And we'd be happy to, of course, submit it as supplemental evidence.
Okay, actually, that would be helpful if you could submit
yes,
that.
Yes, that
would be a very good idea.
We'll do that.
You know, when you get up and tell us, well, we've got this, but it's not in the record, it doesn't help for it.
Well, it's in the record in the sense of being attested to in the declaration. I wondered if there was some privacy concern that in some cases bylaws might have features that one wouldn't really want to disclose, but that's not a concern here.
The center is willing to place the bylaws in the record. In the initial instance, he affirmed to the relevant features of the bylaws, but if the court would find it helpful, we are more than happy to supply that information.
If you could just submit that as in the last case by the end of the day tomorrow, that would be very helpful.
Okay, we'll do that, Your Honor. On the merits, there are several challenges that are raised by the center. I'll focus on them in order. The one challenge is that the program fails to account for the onshore infrastructure effects associated with leasing. The program states that onshore effects from development include elimination of wetland habitat and could have a major effect on local indigenous residents. But the Section 18A3 analysis assumes that these harms will be addressed through unspecified mitigation measures that are both perfect and costless.
Was this issue preserved?
Yes. So this is at JA 43, 14, and 15. It's also referenced in our reply brief at page 13, footnote 5. The center specifically raises the issue of infrastructure development and ecosystem concerns. So that it was very clearly preserved. In Watt 1, the court specifically holds that the availability of mitigation measures, and this is a quote, does not mean that consideration of environmental damage may be postponed or foregone. And that is exactly what Interior has done here.
Postponed and foregone are not the same thing. So is this a right question now where there's going to be? This is the programmatic EIS.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Are there not going to be more specific EISs at the time the program is actually in effect?
There will be a specific, more analysis that's done at latter stages, several different types of analysis.
So do you have a rightness problem on this?
On this claim, no.
I know the government said, doesn't say you do, but the intervener.
Which claim is this?
This is under OXLA.
Oh, this is not a NEPA claim.
And
this
is the infrastructure development, the impact of infrastructure development?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay, so this is the one where you basically assigned it zero, or they assigned it zero, and you're
exactly
saying they need to assign it some value.
Some value, or at least explain in something that somewhat plausibly why they're assigning it zero value. Assumption of perfect and costless mitigation measures is implausible, especially without any additional explanation. And in fact, runs counter to other elements of the program, or where they specifically note that these onshore effects will exist. All right, so that's the onshore infrastructure question. I'd like to now focus on the information value delay question. So in response to comments, Interior, in its analysis, examines how uncertainty about the price of oil affects the value of potential lease sales. And this is in the program in its discussion of the fair market value for leases. It refers to that as the hurdle price analysis. That's what Interior does. But Interior fails to give the same treatment to uncertainty about environmental and social costs and provides no reasoned explanation, in fact, no explanation at all, for the differential treatment. Interior also states that in its briefing documents that it delayed some lease sales in order to account for environmental and social uncertainty. But that's not the same thing as actually analyzing the information value of delay with respect to
social. Well, they analyzed it. They say they analyzed it qualitatively, and you want them to analyze it quantitatively. Is that right?
Well, Interior claims that they analyzed it qualitatively. So we raise objections both to the qualitative analysis, but also, yes, the agency should have quantified this analysis or at least offered a reasoned explanation for why it can't offer a quantified analysis. In Watt 1, the court's clear that where a factor is susceptible to quantification, unless it is inherently not susceptible to quantification, the agency should quantify it or at least offer a satisfactory excuse. Here, we don't have any excuse at all for the court to evaluate whether it's satisfactory or not.
Although, is there a requirement? I mean, you're really reading the OXLA to mandate that they employ a particular methodology, and I guess I'm not sure that I read the statute to be so precise on that question, or at least it seems
right.
Like maybe you could help me out with that.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. So Section 18A1 refers to environmental, social, and economic values. Information cost of delay is an economic value. The environmental and social uncertainty is directly related both to that economic value and obviously to environmental and social values. The Secretary acknowledges that this is an important class of value by itself engaging in the analysis through its hurdle price analysis. But what the Secretary does is only account for price uncertainty in its hurdle price analysis and fails to account for uncertainty with respect to environmental.
I mean, you'd have to acknowledge that this is a kind of a new economic field getting into quantifying, whereas price of oil, that's a pretty old, there's a market and
sure.
There's a lot of sort of professional expertise over generations on that side. So is it not reasonable for the agency to say, well, this is, you know, this may be coming, this is kind of avant-garde right now, mm-hmm. We'll look at it, but hold off on analyzing it for the time being? Is that not a permissible position?
Well, the agency doesn't actually hold that position. So if the agency were to say, look, we're applying this methodology, we're going to try it out on the price side, we recognize that there are methodologies, because there are methodologies to deal with the environmental social cost side that were presented by commenters. And it's actually not that avant-garde. It's been around for several decades. But if the agency had included a discussion along those lines, then we would have a different case. And there would be deference to that kind of decision. It could still not be adequately considered, but that's a different, that, you know, we're in a different situation. The situation we have right now is where the agency fails to even explain its decision not to look at social and environmental, uncertainty around social and environmental costs. So we can't
in
even
a quantitative
evaluate
way.
In a quantitative way. Mm-hmm. And actually doesn't explain why it used a qualitative methodology instead of a quantitative methodology when commenters pointed out to the existence of the quantitative methodology. Again, it's got a three-decade history. It's something that the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the White House recommends agencies to do in contests exactly like this. And I can actually quote from the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs A4 circular, which was pointed out to the agency in comments, as long as taking time will lower uncertainty either passively or actively through investment in information gathering, and some costs are irreversible, such as the potential sunk costs of investment, a benefit can be assigned to the option value to delay a decision, and OIR recommends that be done when it can be. So if there are no further questions on that issue, I have a little bit of time to discuss the regional allocation issue. So the Secretary enjoys discretion on how to strike a balance between the factors, but only after considering statutory factors, including an equitable sharing of risks and benefits. Interior does not have the discretion to ignore a substantial regional transfer of environmental risks, which here in the program is exactly what Interior does. There's a difference between the no-sale option and the leasing program. The no-sale option creates, under Interior's analysis, environmental costs at the Atlantic and Pacific and onshore. The leasing option creates risks in the Gulf and Alaska. But Interior, in its Section A3 economic analysis, treats those costs that occur in the Pacific and Atlantic and onshore as though they were occurring in Alaska and the Gulf. And if an equitable sharing of benefits and risk means anything, it means that Interior cannot pretend like this Large transfer of risk isn't occurring.
But that's a little strange. I mean, you're basically you would be proposing a way of assessing costs that would, I mean, how could they, for example, consider under your proposal costs of coal plants? There aren't coal plants in Alaska. So what they're saying is if we don't issue these leases, we're going to have some costs. And those costs would occur, you know, in the Atlantic Seaboard or around the country. And only if we kind of attribute them as the opportunity costs of these, you know, not leasing, are we going to actually be balancing the applicable factors. So I'm just a little puzzled by your proposal and how it would adequately take the costs into account.
Right. So it would work very similarly to the way that Interior, the fundamentals are there in the analysis for Interior. In fact, the default model in their offshore economic model actually attributes the cost to where they're expected to occur. But what Interior does is then overrides that default and kind of forces the model to treat the cost as though they were occurring in the regions. Now, what Interior, I think, has two arguments here. One is that it's only looking at the regions, and it's permissible for Interior to only look at the included regions. And then kind of as a supplement to that, that if they don't treat these costs as though they're incurring in the regions, that they won't be looked at. So the center is not claiming that these costs should not be looked at. That's actually in the briefs a little bit on the government side. I just want to clarify that is in no way the center's position. The center's position is only that the costs be treated where they actually occur.
Well, what's wrong with Judge Pillard's question,
right,
which is that this is an opportunity cost. The consequence is to not building it in one place imposes costs on another, which is building it, and so it's all right to impose it on in some proportional way in a place where it could be built, but instead is not going to be built there. Why is that an arbitrary and capricious point?
It's the decision to actually move forward with leasing. We're not challenging the striking of the balance. We're challenging the analysis, the consideration.
I understand, right, but I'm asking why is that analysis arbitrary and capricious? That's the question, right?
Right, because it fails to recognize that there's a substantial regional element to this transfer.
It does recognize it. What it recognizes is, again, in the words Judge Pillard used, that one region, if we don't build there, imposes a cost on another. Why is that arbitrary and capricious? They certainly have considered it. Now the only question is, why is that consideration arbitrary and capricious?
The agency treats those costs in its economic analysis as though they are occurring. So in Alaska, to be concrete, they are treating the cost that will occur in the Atlantic and Pacific as though it's occurring in Alaska. So it's an opportunity cost of not drilling in Alaska, mm-hmm, but those costs are not incurred in Alaska if the leasing were not to occur. Those costs would be incurred elsewhere. And the point is that the Interior must recognize and consider that regional transfer of risk. So what is not happening is we're not trading two types of environmental costs in Alaska against each other. We're trading environmental risk in Alaska versus environmental risk in the Pacific and Atlantic. And it's okay, ultimately, for Interior to balance these things against each other under its Section 18A3 discretion. But it first must consider an equitable sharing of risks and benefits. And if that means anything, it means across the regions in 18A2. That's a regional consideration.
So I think they are taking into account where the costs are going to be borne. But, for example, if one of the things that they're considering is, would it be better to do leasing in the Gulf or in Alaska? Mm-hmm. And there are factors that, I don't know, make more efficient production available in Alaska. They want to say, well, if we forego that level of that kind of efficient production, that's going to have an impact on the country. Mm-hmm. And so if we attach those costs to Alaska, then when we're weighing these two alternatives against one another, it's going to appropriately be tagged where it has an impact for our decision. That's obviously in the terms of a judge, not an economist, how I understand their justification, and correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that seems roughly correct with what Interior's justification is. The problem is, so there's no claim that the, certainly the center's not claiming that these opportunity costs shouldn't be recognized as opportunity costs for not drilling in Alaska. right? So that's it's kind of stage one is the no-sale option means less drilling in Alaska, less oil out of Alaska, right? So that's the case. And then what Interior does not do is it not tell us where those opportunity costs are occurring, right? So it could easily do that. This would not be a complex analysis. Interior, basically, the model is already set up to do it. So Interior can just know, you know, when there's one less barrel of oil coming out of Alaska, on a pro rata basis, that creates opportunity costs on the Atlantic coast, the Pacific coast, and elsewhere on our shore, right? That's the analysis that we're describing. So that Interior doesn't just aggregate it all up at the national level. It can do that in its ultimate 18A3 striking a balance consideration, but it first has to consider an equitable sharing, and that means, at the very least, identifying on a regional basis where the trade-offs are occurring.
Further questions?
Thank you.
We'll hear from Interior.
May it please the Court, I am David Shulton, representing the Department of the Interior. With me at council table is Stephen Rosenbaum, who represents the intervener. I'll speak first to the question of standing, specifically the associational standing issue. This Court has said in Sierra Club versus...
If we get a bylaw that says that they have members, is that not the end of the question about associational standing?
Well, if the bylaws were to show that the association functions to represent members...
Well, they say, A, they have members, and B, the members elect the board, voting to elect the board. That's still not enough?
Well, actually, Dr. Talbert's declaration
says... I'm just asking, we're going to get a bylaw, so if it's not as represented, then there'll be more questions. But assuming
one of us doesn't totally buy into what the Chief Judge said, go ahead and speak to that when you could, please.
Sorry, I think my point is that the burden was on the petitioners, if standing was raised like it was in a motion to dismiss, to at the first opportunity come forward with facts showing their standing. The burden is the same as it would be at summary judgment.
Even if they have members, unless they are representing an interest of the members that is a concrete interest that is subject to injury on these facts, that isn't sufficient, is it?
That is correct. And so all that Dr. Talbert's declaration says is that we have categories of members. It doesn't say anything about how the association functions to represent them and if it represents them to protect their concrete interests. So there was a big evidentiary gap here, and I don't think that petitioners should be allowed to make it up at the very end of the case. I think it was their burden to come forward with facts at the time that standing was challenged, just like in summary judgment.
Do you have any authority for that? Because that is a tricky issue for us. Obviously, we have to satisfy ourselves of our jurisdiction, and it's one of the rare situations in which we sometimes do get factual submissions in this court. But is there authority for they had their chance, they made a record, they failed to do that, and therefore they shouldn't be given the opportunity now?
Well, I would point to this court's decision in Sierra Club versus EPA, which is about petitions for review generally and the burden. But I would also point to the Supreme Court's decision in Summers versus Earth Island, an environmental standing case from about 4 or 5 years ago, where the plaintiff tried to repair its inadequate standing showing with declarations, but they came in sort of late in the case, not when they were supposed to come in, and the Supreme Court said that's too bad.
Was that a district court? Did that originally arise in the district court?
That was a district court.
Right. So in our court, we have repeatedly allowed additional filings at this stage, including post-argument. The Summers case is one where there's a motion for summary judgment. It's not presented at that point. That's the end of it. But we have not yet reached a resolution in this case. So we're not really at a critical stage until we reach a final decision about standing. No decision about standing has yet been made in this case.
Well, I haven't seen any cases which consider this specific question with something like associational standing. But I think the guidance that I read from Sierra Club versus EPA is that they should do it at the first opportunity.
What was the other point you made in response to Judge Santel? I think it's about whether they actually represent their members on this issue, something like that?
Well, yes, they have That really goes to the germaneness issue. And germaneness really is about whether this organization is, you know, one with expertise on the particular subject. And it goes to, I think, the fairness part of this associational standing test, which is that members who join an organization, if they know that the organization has expertise in a particular area, like the protection of marine resources, then they're comfortable with the fact that the organization appears in court to challenge projects which allegedly hurt the marine environment. But this organization claims expertise simply in economic analysis.
Well, that was the only argument. You have affidavits of the members who say we're comfortable with them representing our interests in court. So,
well,
if that's the question, fairness to the members, these members are saying we're comfortable with this.
These two may be, but we don't really know that the organization generally has expertise in these sorts of issues, marine protection issues, and so we don't know about the other members.
Well, it's a little bit different expertise that they're claiming. I mean, as we know, many of these issues of exploitation of natural resources are driven by economic models and what's internalized in those models, and they're not just an economic think tank. They're for sustainable economics, and so really what that's saying is we're about counting environmental effects that haven't been adequately counted, and that may be methodologically a little bit different from, you know, NRDC, but it seems like if you see it as not an economics think tank and it's writ large, but, you know, about taking account in economic methodology of environmental impact, I'm not sure that I see the flaw in terms of germaneness.
I think the flaw is in the breadth, that could apply to any government decision that's backed by economic methodology. And I think this court's decision in the Humane Society versus Odell case kind of points out what the real problem is here. It says that the germaneness prong ensures a modicum of concrete adverseness by preventing associations from being merely law firms with standing. And I think that's the problem here, is that the center is acting as a law firm that believes it can sue whenever the government does something that can be characterized as not promoting a sustainable economy by the simple expedient of finding one or two of its clients or supporters who will state that they are injured by the particular government action. So I think that this does go beyond what the court has.
You respond to the argument about allocation of the costs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think the problem with the center's argument is it's confusing two parts of the analysis that the Department of Interior does. The department does a net benefits analysis. That's the quantitative cost benefits analysis. But it does other analyses as well. One of those is an equitable sharing analysis that looks at the equity of the situation of the different regions. That's done qualitatively. Now,
that's the second issue. The issue I would like first is this question of allocating the costs to Alaska, the opportunity costs to Alaska.
I was making too long of an introduction. I apologize.
Yeah. The leasing area is
issue. Attribution of cost to Alaska is done as part of the net benefits analysis, the quantitative analysis. For purposes of that analysis only, Interior says, well, if we forego production in a particular area, that's going to have some impacts. There'll be increased imports, increased domestic production. That'll have some costs. And those costs ought to be attributed to the area, the program area, where the production is not going to be produced, in order to do a fair comparison for purposes of our net public benefits analysis. But then it considers, Interior is very aware that those impacts will be occurring in a different place, and it takes that into account in its other analyses, like the equitable sharing analysis and its analysis of impacts on the coastal zone. So it's only for the net benefits analysis that it makes this attribution determination, and it explained why it does that. This is at JA 1873-74, said that tying benefits and costs to the source program area is a relatively transparent way to represent the domestic benefits and costs likely to result from approving each individual program area option. It allows a consistent framework for the Secretary to make decisions about which program areas to include in the leasing program. In order to make a sensible comparison, you have to consider all of the potential costs of either proceeding or not proceeding, whether or not they occur in that area. So the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act tells Interior to consider the nationwide impacts. It's a national program, and that's why Interior considers costs wherever they occur and attributes them to the program area.
Mr. Shelton, I wonder if you could address the informational value question. One way of reading Watt 1 is that where something can be quantified, it really must be quantified. And so I wonder why the future information values are being dealt with in a more seat-of-the-pants way in this context, on this record.
Well, Watt 1 and Watt 2 and NRDC versus Hodel all recognize that environmental costs are not really amenable to quantification in most cases, are very difficult to quantify. And I don't think those cases suggest that there's a requirement that you quantify those factors. And so that's the reason why Interior, in its hurdle price analysis, did consider the cost of delay economically, for considering the value of the oil itself, because there's a recognized way to do that. But when it comes to the value of waiting for more information on environmental impacts, there's no established methodology for assigning a value to that. And so there's no requirement that this be done quantitatively rather than qualitatively. Of course, Interior does think about, is it valuable to wait for more information? It did that with a Chukchi Sea sale and said, we will put that sale, one sale, at the very end of the program to give us more time to develop information about environmental impacts. But there's no established methodology for figuring out, what dollar value one should put on waiting and the new information you may get.
Well, is that right? I mean, what about OIRA's urging the agencies to do just that? I mean, the economic studies in the record. I mean, there's a whole literature that's, probably grown up since some of the early litigation under this act that really is precisely doing that. And indeed, many commentators have noticed, including in this record, that if that's not done, that systematically the environmental impacts are going to be undervalued, underappreciated in the decision-making process.
Well, I think this record shows that Interior didn't undervalue the environmental resources, and the Chukchi decision, I think, shows that. But I think more specifically, this Court's cases have said that the choice of methodology is up to Interior, and that choice gets a large amount of deference. If there is a new methodology that's being developed in this area, it's something that Interior can look at, but the choice is really up to the agency as to whether to dive in and try that new methodology. There's no requirement that it adopt each new methodology that comes along and maybe is at this new stage. So I think that the deference point is really an important one here. The Section 18 factors, and there are eight of them, all have to be considered and balanced, and the courts have recognized that that's a very difficult undertaking, that the only direction in the OCSLA is that Interior, to the extent possible, arrive at a proper balance, and that's very general language, and so that's caused the courts to say that Interior does have a great deal of discretion.
I see your time is limited, and I don't want to take up all the time, but I wonder if you could, assuming it's not waived, just address how is it not irrational for Interior to treat as zero the ecological impacts of the onshore infrastructure development.
So I do think it's waived. If you look at the comments, they did not go to the issue of whether Interior was ignoring that cost. They simply mentioned wetlands, so it was a different issue. So it was waived. But even if not, center is just pointing to one sentence in the economic model, which says that for purposes of coming up with values for the net benefits analysis, we'll assume that costs that onshore infrastructure will be mitigated, and that will be done. That's a reasonable assumption when you're trying to figure out, you know, what the costs are. But in the qualitative part of Interior's analysis, in the EIS, and in the program itself, Interior certainly considered onshore impacts, including pipeline impacts and infrastructure impacts. And we have the sites in our brief. So it gave it full qualitative consideration, but there was no...
Isn't there a tension there? I mean, you're giving it qualitative consideration, and then you're saying on the numbers side, we're going to zero it out. It seems like that's lip service, no?
No,
almost
because
by definition?
The net benefits analysis... it's not determinative. What Interior does, as it explained in its proposed final decision, is it looks at the net benefits analysis just to determine whether the benefits are significantly higher than the costs for the various options. If they are, then they consider a list of other factors, including environmental factors. So it's just really a threshold matter. So the qualitative factors do play an important role in the decision. Unless there are other questions, thank you.
Thank you. Does the petitioner have any time?
Is
the intervener?
No, it's all right.
We'll give I'll give you 2 more minutes.
My bad.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the germaneness question, which there was some discussion, I'd like to just note that the standard here is modest. The modest standard is that the litigation goals be pertinent to the organization's purpose. That's from Humane Society v. Hodel. That standard is relatively loose, and it's meant to exclude certain kinds of challenges. If you look at Humane Society, that case provides some helpful illustrations of the kinds of cases that the germaneness standard is meant to exclude, things like leaders of a labor union pressing an establishment clause challenge to a school aid program where it's completely unrelated to the organization's mission. Here, the center's mission is to speed the transition to a sustainable economy that's intimately related to the use of renewable and non-renewable resources, including offshore resources, and the members' economic and recreational interests in those interests in those resources, as well as the expertise of the organization in environmental and resource economics. And so There's a strong relationship here, much more than just general pertinent.
Between speeding the transition to a sustainable economy and the recreational interest of the putative members.
So
how does it affect the speeding to a sustainable economy, one way or the other, to have plenty of fish or not many fish? I suppose one could say there is some Venn diagram overlap there, but I'm having a hard time finding it.
Sure. So why would someone like Mr. Shavelson join an organization like the Center for a Sustainable Economy, given his recreational interest in Alaska, to take that exact concrete question?
But transitioning to a sustainable economy does not seem to have a one-for-one relationship with maintaining the fishing grounds.
Right. I'm not sure that that's what's required for the germaneness standard, but just to take the question, the sustainable use of natural resources is very closely connected to a wide range of interests, potentially recreational interests. So, for example, in Alaska, if we use less oil, then the recreational interests of Mr. Shavelson are preserved. That's direct connexus in this case. To take just on the discretion on methodology, the center is not arguing that the agency doesn't have discretion in this case. What the agency needs to do is explain its decisions. And what the agency did not do in this case is explain adequately why it's zeroing out the onshore effects, why it's failed to account for social and economic uncertainty about social and economic costs in its hurdle price analysis and its options analysis. I see I'm out of time. I appreciate the court's time.
We'll take the matter under submission.